I'm Dan Hartnett, and I'm a professor at Kenyon College. Whenever I'm socializing with my colleagues, I inevitably end up asking them questions about the fascinating research they do. I thought other people might be interested in our conversations too. So I decided to start a podcast to ask Kenyon faculty about their research, their fields, and how they get students involved. This is the Kenyon College Profcast. My guest today is Kate Elkins. Kate is the founder of the Comparative World Literature Program at Kenyon. Her scholarship bridges literature, philosophy, and most recently, artificial intelligence. She has worked extensively on Marcel Proust and Charles Baudelaire throughout her career. Kate is currently serving as the National Endowment for the Humanities Distinguished Teaching Professor of Comparative Literature and Humanities. In this capacity, she's trying to bridge the gap between computer science and the humanities. I sat down with Kate in March of 2019. Kate, I want to thank you for making time to be on the podcast.
It is a pleasure to be here.
You founded the Comparative World Literature Program here. Many places either have comparative literature or world literature, but our program includes both. How do comparative literature and world literature fit together?
That's a great question. You know, world literature started as this attempt to critique comp lit, because one of the problems with comp lit or comparative literature is it really started out partially as an impetus from faculty that fled World War II and came to the U.S. Many of them were trained in European languages, and it was highly Eurocentric. And even throughout the time after World War II into, say, the 1980s, many of us who studied comparative literature would study French, German. There would be the usual suspects, and many of them were from European literature. To some extent, it's easier if you work, say, in romance literatures. You know, you study Spanish, French, there is some overlap in terms of linguistics and language. But it's also true that there's also a flow of ideas between many of these countries. And so it's easier to compare because you're often writing about and reading authors who've read each other, especially with the rise of the novel. All the novelists are reading each other in the 19th century across these national boundaries. And so that's how comparative literature arose. When we move to world literature, we have a critique that comp lit is so Eurocentric, that we're working in the same literatures. Why are we really focusing on Europe or maybe some Latin America? And so what world literature did is ask us, what about all these other languages, all these other books that we're not reading? And it really was a welcome critique, but it's also very challenging because it is hard to teach and it's even harder to do research if you can't read the original. You have all of these new cultures and histories to learn. And so there is a tension between wanting to read widely and read in these areas in which we may not come with the same kind of expertise, but at the same time, you know, incorporating what we already know. So there is a little bit of a tension, but what I would say in recent years is that these two fields really have melded to some extent. And part of that is, I think, because we now have a much clearer idea about how stories, how poems have crossed cultures. There's been a lot more really interesting work about the connections between Asia and Europe and Latin America. And so as we develop more precise history of the way in which these cultures interact, we're able to incorporate these fields more. And I do like that there is less antagonism that there really was in the beginning between these two fields.
What is that division or that, I don't even know, that sort of reabsorption look like in a curriculum now?
I think one of the interesting things is the way in which, and this is going to bring up my latest foray into digital humanities a bit, we're beginning to investigate the way that stories have crossed cultures, and people are even using genetic algorithms to develop evolutionary trees of how we think that stories are moving between different cultures. So on the one hand, we're able to compare much more widely than we used to be able to compare. On the other hand, one of the really important things that world literature does is stress that sometimes we shouldn't compare, or that there is no comparison, or there are ways in which by comparing we reduce the singularity of a particular culture or a particular text. And so, you know, one of the really important things to do as a comparatist is always to ask, what can we get out of the comparison and make sure that we're not ignoring certain things, evading certain things, reducing everything to comparisons that aren't there.
What are some of the big questions that a comparatist asks?
You know, comparative literature is a huge, baggy tent, and it's undergone many different metamorphoses. Back when I was first training in the field, theory was big, and, you know, I was part of that whole thing. I moved to Europe. I studied with Jacques Derrida because I thought that was totally cool. And so we were all doing theory. And I would say since then, we've had an evolution away from that into other kinds of questions. I myself happen to work on the interrelationship between music and literature, painting and literature. So we're asking questions about what is art. Is the kind of art that we find in music or painting the same as the kind of art that we see in literature? I also work in the field of literature and philosophy, and this is sort of the 2.0 version of the theory movement. And I think it's maybe returned to the origins of philosophy a little bit more and a little bit more connected to philosophy as a discipline. So a little bit more grounded in that way. There's also a very strong post-colonial interest in comparative literature. And what interests me, one of the fields I'm working on, is this interest in Northern Asia, so Japan and China, and its influence on European modernism. So that's something that I work on that's very, very interesting.
You came to one of my department's meetings in the fall to tell us about a digital humanities workshop you were creating through the NEH professorship. Can you tell me a little bit about how this collaboration works?
Let me just say that there's a lot of hostility towards digital humanities. And I think that the way that we're trying to do it at Kenyon is a little bit different from the norm because we're very aware of the ways in which digital humanities held a lot of promise but didn't really deliver. So digital humanities is trying to use newer technology to reinvigorate or maybe add something to humanities study. What we found with the first phases was it was really about archiving. So we had new ability to search text, which today seems totally normal, but, you know, just the way we can now use Google and Google Scholar to research is completely different from how it was done 20 years ago. So in some ways, these have brought about profound changes, but they're almost invisible because we've just changed our practice. The most recent interesting development, in my opinion, is that recently industry has developed some very, very interesting tools to deal with text. And this is because the World Wide Web has given us so much language to analyze that all kinds of businesses and Google, everybody from Google to Facebook wants to know how to analyze text. The reason why this is interesting is it used to be that we were using very, very old tools in digital humanities. They might be counting words. They would be very, very simple. But now we have available open access to state-of-the-art tools that deal with text. So this is precisely the kind of thing that we literary scholars do. And the question is, can we repurpose these tools for our interests to ask the kinds of questions that we want to ask? And I think we can.
Now, you're working with a group of faculty and students to expand how it is that we might use these tools. What are some of the tasks that the professors take on, and what are some of the tasks that the students take on?
Well, what we wanted to do first is have faculty understand how these tools work and whether they're useful to them. Because one of the problems with computational approaches is if you start from the beginning, you have to learn Python, you have to learn how to clean your data. It's all, frankly, extremely tedious. And so we wanted faculty to first see what these computational tools could show them. And then if they're interested, they can go back and learn, but they can also work in a group very collaboratively and bring their own domain expertise without having to learn how to be really good coders. So we are having the students do much of the computational work. And then in a workshop together, the students will help the faculty explore the results of these computational approaches.
So let's talk about some of the tools that you might use for this. Can you tell me about some of the ways artificial intelligence is being used as a tool for reading literary texts?
So artificial intelligence can mean machine learning. It can also mean neural nets. And machine learning uses statistics. Now, we may think that, oh, what can statistics do? It's just simple frequency counting. But in fact, it can do some interesting things. And one of the examples is LDA or topic modeling. One of the ideas about digital humanities is it can deal with very large amounts of text. And topic modeling is one of those tools that does do that. Now, there are other tools, and I can talk about those later, that I do think are work very well with smaller amounts of text. But the reason topic modeling was designed was in industry, people had vast amounts of articles or texts, and they wanted to find out what they were about. And so simply enough, they just used this process to group various words into topics. Now, obviously, the computer has no idea it's a topic. It does not call it a topic. All it does is find out words that are near each other with the assumption that words that often appear frequently together must be linked in some particular way. Now, you as the human then go in and see, try to figure out what this group of words is. Sometimes it's extremely surprising. You might recognize some words as a particular topic, but then there's another word that's always appearing with that topic that might be surprising. So I'll give you just a couple of examples of students in our classes who have used these. One student was very interested in transitional justice, and so he looked at United Nations general speeches and found terms about transitional justice using topic modeling over time and which countries were using them and which countries were not. You can pretty much guess which countries would be more on that forefront. Another student was very interested in looking at Supreme Court decisions regarding abortion, and she looked at all of the decisions starting in the 1970s up until the present and tracked very different language changing to more recent decisions that are more and more concerned with medical procedure and words like fetus and various procedural aspects. And so she made an argument that we really have seen a shift in the kinds of judgments that the Supreme Court is making, and even asks whether the Supreme Court should be weighing in on medical procedures, right? So that's an example of using topic modeling to have some sense. Another student is very interested in comedy. And so he used topic modeling to look at television comedies starting in the 1950s all the way to the present, I Love Lucy to the present. And he wanted to see if comedy changed. Just out of curiosity, would you think that comedy would have changed since the 1950s? Would our the words used in comedic, would you expect change or not?
I don't know. You know, I'm a medievalist, and I would say probably not, actually.
Probably not. And so this is an example where no result is actually a result, that we think we've come so far, you know, and we're going to have all these changes in what's funny. And in fact, very little has changed. One thing that he did notice is that talk about Christmas dropped out and Thanksgiving, you know, came in. So we did see a little bit of a secularization. And the other thing that he noticed is that women continue to be the butt of jokes in terms of dating from the 1950s to the present. So there actually wasn't much change. So, you know, here, that's a great tool in terms of dealing with a lot of text and seeing changes or no change over time in terms of which words appear together.
Now, you've also talked about sentiment analysis before. What is that?
So sentiment analysis was developed by industry, and this is another example of a tool that we have repurposed to look at literature. And you can imagine in the marketplace, it's very important for industry, for businesses to be able to take a vast number of comments and immediately tell positive or negative emotional sentiment. Do they like it? Do they not like it? What's the emotional reaction? The same for movie reviews, for example. So that's how it was designed. But there is a researcher named Matthew Jockers who began to use it in literary studies. And since then, we've had many, many other people use it. What it does is it has a huge vocabulary of words that humans decide in terms of whether they're positive or negative. Angry would be negative, sad would be negative, happy, joyous, all of this kind of thing. And so people have started to analyze literary texts. And this, for me, has been groundbreaking because I've taught the novel for years and years, and I've never imagined that a narrative arc could be understood in terms of emotional change. But in fact, that's what researchers have found. They have found that underlying most narrative plots, you see ups and downs of emotions, and that this is a kind of wave that rides through most novels. And you can actually track them, and they look very different. They're different kinds of emotional arcs, but it's just been fascinating for me. So I have been working on that, and I've been very interested in this underlying emotional arc of novels.
Well, it sounds like it's a bit English dependent because it was maybe developed for industry within the English-speaking world. Is this something that exists outside of English-speaking?
Yes, they do have different dictionaries now for different languages, so they're a little bit more complicated to use. And you also, the nice thing about English right now is we do have a researcher at Stanford who had all of his graduate students hand-mark texts and compare the computational model to the students. And so we do have some confirmation that that one is pretty accurate. I'm not sure we have the same thing with these other models. But again, this is a situation in which we have industry that obviously is interested in this across languages. So we have great developments. The other thing I would say is that artificial intelligence performs at a much higher level. So some people are beginning to use much more sophisticated approaches to this. The one that we've been using so far has been fairly simple, but there are much more sophisticated methods. And some artificial intelligence, get this, can actually learn to translate on its own. So GPT-2, which just came out, they trained it on many, many words. And what they found was that there were enough sentences in French that it actually learned how to translate French even without being taught. So we are getting these advances in terms of working across languages or in different languages.
How does vectorization of semantic space work? It's a really sort of intimidating title in some ways. Is it an intimidating technique as well?
Well, let me give you an example. It can actually create analogies. So I'm interested in the question of what is the relationship between space and time in Proust. There's all this debate about, is Proust really talking about time or is he really talking about space? Well, if you embed the entire text in semantic space, I could give the program spaces to time, and it would actually give me the pair of words that were in the exact same semantic relationship, closest to that. So it is actually understanding the relations between words. Now, you might say this is an underlying structure. What could this actually have to do with meaning? But one of the really interesting things to me is that what we're finding out is that if you understand the relationships between words, you begin to have access to the meaning.
You mentioned neural nets. Are those being used to read literature too?
Yes. They are a form of unsupervised computational processes. So maybe the first way to start for the listener is to understand that there's been a major shift in the way that people are dealing with text. And I say this because even our students sometimes misunderstand. For a long time, programmers worked with something called computational linguistics. This is very much influenced by Chomsky. He had notions of kind of underlying grammar, and you would teach the computer these kinds of rules of grammar. And then the computer could begin to break down language into grammatical structures. And so this was very much the way it worked. And as Chomsky fell somewhat out of favor, and as we got these new computational tools that are unsupervised, we have developed different ways of understanding language that work very differently. And there's a joke in Silicon Valley that every time a company fired its computational linguist, they improved in terms of their computational ability. So the reason it may seem sort of arbitrary, like who cares about this? But the reason it's important is that computational linguistics was giving computers instructions about how to understand language. And now what they're doing with artificial intelligence is they're just giving the computer lots of language, like a baby, and just asking it to figure out how language works. And so it's what we call unsupervised. And this is producing very, very different results.
What advantages do computers have, and what advantages do human readers have when it comes to analyzing literature?
Well, one of the things that's concerned me in recent years about teaching literature is our ideal is that we put students in front of a text and we teach them to listen to the text and get rid of all their preconceptions, right? So it's getting away from bias, moving the student beyond their limited perspective. That, in an ideal world, is what we're supposed to do. But whether we always achieve that is another matter. And sometimes I worry that we are enabling students, for better or for worse, to pick a few choice passages from a text and argue for a thesis as hard as they can, even if there may be other things in the text that completely contradict it, right? Or historical circumstances or context. And so, especially in this day and age where everybody has to deal with so much information and make sense of what is fake news and what is not, I feel like we need to make sure that for our literature students too, we are teaching them to move beyond confirmation bias, that we are making sure that they learn how to consider things which would contradict their hypothesis, that they look at the whole text. Now, that's actually pretty hard to look at the whole text sometimes. If you know, is it legitimate to say that this is an important theme in a book if it only happens in one tiny passage? That's a real methodological question. But can a student who's new to a long novel really have in their mind all the patterns in the text? Probably not. So one of the things that I like about computation is it may be able sometimes to help us look at what we're looking at better and actually be grounded in what is there. And then we can bring our own interpretation to it. But it's extremely difficult to do well, especially, like I said, if you deal, I teach Proust and his novel is more than 3,000 pages long. Even for an expert, it's hard to keep the whole thing in one's head. And you can imagine one scholar argues that this thing is important. Well, it is for 50 pages and another thing. And so computation helps us see all kinds of interesting patterns, including emotions, over a much larger span and give us some feedback as to what we're arguing. And we could argue against it, but at least we see that it's there.
Is there an objectivity of perspective that's introduced with these computer-assisted tools?
Well, it always has to be judged against the human, right? And so, you know, one of the difficulties, and this has been a critique of some work in digital humanities, is that they're very weak signals that people build entire interpretations on. I think it's really important to begin teaching students to see the difference between weak signals and strong signals. And that's true whether it's our own human brain or it's the computer. Now, sometimes the computer will turn up weak signals. But to me, it's the same kind of phenomenon as a human reader. And it's really important that we begin teaching students how to distinguish between those. The computer, you know, always has to be checked by a human, right? We always have to bring our knowledge of history, our knowledge of context, our knowledge about the author, all of these things to bear.
What surprising readings have come out of the use of some of these AI tools?
Well, one of the first things that I wanted to look at is the modernist novel, because many people often argue that the modernist novel is plotless. And so when I began to explore this possibility that you can see plot by graphing sentiment, I immediately wanted to see whether some modernist novels were indeed plotless. And so I picked a Virginia Woolf novel, and I suspected that there was a plot, and sure enough, there was. But not all of her novels do, in fact, have that kind of a plot. And so it's really helped me understand how these novels work emotionally, which points are the high points, why is that? We can actually see it on a graph. I sort of imagined it, but it was also really a lovely surprise. And it was also a surprise to see the similarities between some of her emotional arcs and other stories, a long tradition of storytelling.
What are the limits of these tools for literary analysis?
There is some sense in which it's not very good for dealing with irony. Now, there are actually people working on artificial intelligence in India who claim to have something like 80% accuracy with irony. And you also always have to compare these tools against humans, because humans are not perfect. And if you've ever taught a literature class in which there's a passage that's ironic, I would say that you're lucky if 80% of the class actually identifies it as such. So satire, irony, so far really are not areas that we can deal with well. I would also say that we still very much are in the hybrid model, where we need a human and the computation. We are nowhere near, you know, it's not like the computer is going to interpret the text, and so we don't need to read them anymore by any stretch. We're really talking about if this tool can help us do our job better.
You've been relying on a number of tools that were developed for industry, which means that in some ways they develop the tools for their own uses and then we as literature professors repurpose them. Are there tools you wish you had that industry maybe just has no interest in developing at the moment?
I think that what we need are really more scholars using these tools to give us more data points. And as an example, you know, I have a few students who've been graphing various emotional arcs in novels, but to me, we won't really be anywhere until we've graphed hundreds of novels and we can begin overlaying them and exploring the similarities and differences. So in terms of going beyond that, I mean, you know, I don't want to replace the human. so I'm not looking for that. I will say that I am amazed at what's happened with AI-generated text, even since December when we taught our AI for the Humanities course. And this new GPT-2, which OpenAI came out with, they've only released the what they call the lobotomized version because they fear that it's such a dangerous tool. But the generation of art, the generation of text mm-hmm. is fascinating and scary. So that has happened very quickly. And I'm still thinking about what this means for how we understand language.
Now, you said it is potentially dangerous. Dangerous how?
Well, OpenAI, and this is the irony, OpenAI was started by Elon Musk, and there was a fear of what AI could do. And so it was started with the notion of total transparency and making everything available. And ironically, OpenAI refuses to release GPT-2, right? So this is a real development. And their argument is that the market could be flooded with fake news, that it writes so well that people could use it to generate all kinds of fake news, and that it would be almost impossible for people to distinguish whether it was written by a human or computer. So that's the fear.
Is there any chance we're moving toward a new type of literary scholar that uses AI in some ways as an extension of human capacities, as just sort of a regular tool in our toolkit?
I mean, that's what I would like to see. You know, one of the questions is, are we advocating for kind of literary criticism that's like art, where it's about what we feel, it's about what we can create, and it doesn't really matter what the author thought, it doesn't really matter, you know, what all the patterns are in the book. If you see something and you think it's important, you write about it. And that's one version of literary criticism that comes out of a tradition, the birth of the reader, it's really about the reception of the work. And if so, then we should see ourselves as artists. And I do think that there's something very liberating in that view. It's creative. It's wonderful. But then we're all, you know, as the Dadaists would say, we're all talking about our own boom boom, you know. That was their expression, right? We're each saying our own boom boom. And are we really connecting? Or is there something about some of these texts that we can agree on? And if so, what are our methods, right? And to me, we are in a period where we will, whether we want to or not, have to ask and answer some of these questions. And I think there's room for both approaches. But I like the idea of maybe using some of these tools to ask, can we do it better? Hmm. Right? And are there elements which we can agree on about how the text is working or what's happening in the text?
What are you working on right now?
I'm really excited about these word embeddings. So I'm working on a project looking at Marcel Proust, who, with all his thousands of pages, is a little bit hard to get a handle on, especially looking at whether after he won a literary prize, whether his writing changed, and not just using stylometry, which is a kind of old-fashioned way of looking at his style, but looking with these much more nuanced ways of analyzing the text to see if we can see a kind of change.
Is there anything you wish other literary scholars knew about AI in case they were, let's say, skeptical about it or scared of it in some sense?
Well, I think we always have to have a balanced approach. And when I started working with these tools, I thought, I'm just going to do what I've always done, but use these tools to do it. And the reality is, it's changed the way I see literature. It's changed the kinds of questions I ask. So I think it's naive to say that we'll just bring on these tools and it will all be the same. I do think that there is a role for critique. I think that there's a role for us to argue for what we bring and the human value and the literary value. And I think that we need to do that now. But I think if we just critique and say, no, 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 we won't accept this, then we are not part of a conversation that's happening right now. And I really do think that part of our role is to be part of a conversation about how the world is changing and what these tools are showing us about text and language and how we think. You know, should we be afraid? Absolutely, because these things may change the way that we think. But I think more information is better, and I think that they open up new questions to ask. And if we're open to that, it's a very, very exciting opportunity.
Is there one thing you wish non-literature scholars knew about your field?
Well, I think that there's a real need for all of us to learn how to move between the quantitative and the qualitative. And that's one of the things that I've done with this new curriculum. We teach some literary students, but we have mostly students who are not literature majors. I think, you know, if you want to be an intellectual today, if you want to weigh in on these issues, you need to understand the technology. And that's one of the kinds of things that we're trying to do. But I also think that one of the things that's happened in the humanities, it's been a very long shift. You can trace it all the way back to Nietzsche, but it's true even through those 80s with all those post-structuralists, is that there's been a move away from wanting to deal with quantitative. And that includes facts, right? Because we believe that there's a social constructedness to the way we interpret the world. And all of that was very necessary and beneficial. It was a reaction against the rise of science in the 19th century. But I think if we don't deal with facts, if we're afraid of facts or we claim that they don't exist, then it is extremely hard for us to weigh in on the pressing problems of the day. And it's also extremely hard to make an argument for the qualitative, which is what we're trying to do. So I would say that, you know, what is great about digital humanities right now is it is suggesting that both the quantitative and the qualitative are important. And that's our goal right now, for students and for faculty, to focus on that.
Kate, thank you so much for coming by.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
This episode was recorded at the Wright Center in downtown Mount Vernon in the beautiful facilities of the Department of Dance, Drama, and Film. My thanks go to my editor and junior producer, Elizabeth Aduma, Kenyon Class of 2020, who recorded this episode, edited it, and made it sound professional. Thank you also to the Center for Innovative Pedagogy that funded this project and consulted on it since the beginning.